This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, the refugee crisis in Europe, its origins and implications. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Europe is grappling with the biggest wave of migration since World War II. As many as 800,000 people seeking asylum are expected to arrive in Germany this year. We have witnessed heartrending images of migrants, but mostly refugees, fleeing persecution in war-torn Syria, who are struggling to find asylum, primarily in Europe. They have paid smugglers to make dangerous voyages from Turkey to Greece, only to be mistreated or denigrated. Hungarian authorities, who make no secret of their disdain for the refugees and are erecting a fence to keep them out, have displayed a xenophobia and Islamophobia that many other European leaders have condemned. Concerns about their economies, ethnic conflicts, and terrorism are raising Europe's xenophobia and Islamophobia, since most of the refugees hail from Muslim-majority countries. But people seem to forget or choose to ignore the fact that the United States and Europe are partly responsible for the current crisis, having contributed to a political and military vacuum in countries such as Libya, Syria, and Iraq. Meantime, the European Union's top executive proposed a plan last week to distribute 160,000 migrants and refugees throughout member states, even while acknowledging that this measure falls woefully short given the depth of the crisis. Well, with us to discuss the root causes of the migrant crisis are two distinguished analysts. Dimitrios Papadimitriou is Distinguished Senior Fellow, President Emeritus, and co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute. That's a Washington-based think tank dedicated to the study of international migration. He's also president of Migration Policy Institute Europe. That's a nonprofit independent research institute in Brussels that aims to promote a better understanding of migration trends and effects within Europe. And Rafif Joujati, she's the English spokeswoman for the Local Coordinating Committees in Syria. That's a network of grassroots activists. She is also director of Free Syria, a nonprofit humanitarian organization that focuses on women's empowerment, and she's a member of the executive committee of the Day After Project, which is developing a transition plan for a post-Assad Syria. And both guests join me here at the VOA Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
It's our pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having me.
Well, let me start with you, Dimitrios Papadimitriou. Let's talk about the root causes and, of course, the difference between migrants and refugees. The Syrians obviously comprise a large majority of the refugees that are coming to Europe. To what extent do you believe that inaction on the part of the West, and perhaps one could argue on part of some of the Arab countries, contributed to driving many of these migrants, some of whom were bona fide refugees from war-torn areas? To what extent should we attribute responsibility?
I think there is enough blame to go around everywhere. So instead of focusing on the blame, let's try to focus on the one or two failures that in many ways are contributing to the chaotic situation in Europe at this time. I think if we go beyond the politics and the failures in Syria and other parts of the Middle East, Iraq and what have you, is the fact that we did not pay enough attention to the people who have left Syria and overwhelmingly have gone to three countries, Jordan, Lebanon, and Turkey. These people have been there sometimes for 2, 3, or 4 years, and they have basically been warehoused in camps. Many of them live outside of the camps. The international response to the needs of these people has been inadequate and very regretfully so, poor. And after a while, people understood that there was no way that they could resume their lives. They could have anything but just the basics if they stayed there. So if you combine the failure to create opportunities for people to resume their lives here, offer education to their children, being able to train people, to create a sense that they can stick around there a little bit longer to see the possibility of something positive happening in Syria, by now they've lost hope. That means they're going to have to move on. The fact that Europe, in a very disorganized way, has opened its doors, in a very disorganized way, I want to emphasize, simply fuels this exodus, as it were. And let's face it, there's also self-interest on the part of the countries that bear 90% of the burden to basically facilitate that movement. If Europe is not going to do the necessary things in Lebanon and the other countries in the immediate region, what we call the first asylum countries, then how about if they can facilitate the flow of people out of those places onto the edge of the Aegean, onto Greece, and then from Greece up through the Western Balkans to Hungary, where, as you said, the circumstances are rather dire.
Indeed. Well, let me turn now to Rafif Joueijati for your perspective. Rafif, you're a native of Syria. You've been working primarily with that situation. I'd like to get your take on to what extent the West, whether it's the United States, Europe, perhaps even some of the Arab countries, to what extent we contributed to the political and military vacuum that occurred in Libya after the rescue of Benghazi and, of course, the death of Gaddafi. Syria not having perhaps acted more quickly earlier in the conflict and even in Iraq.
Since we're talking about the root causes, I think we need to go even before the refugee situation in Turkey and Lebanon and Jordan. We need to look at the root causes of why there are Syrian refugees, period. Knowing now that there are at least 12 million internally displaced or refugee people, this constitutes more than half the population of Syria. And I think we need to point the finger very squarely at the regime of Bashar al-Assad. We need to go back to March of 2011 when students went out in peaceful protest and the regime's response was a military assault on a civilian population. As the revolution continued on and as the military assault grew more fierce, we saw people fleeing. They were fleeing barrel bombs. They were fleeing snipers. They were fleeing cities under siege, shelling, starvation campaigns by the Assad regime. And so they were looking for places to survive. They weren't trying to take other people's jobs or have better opportunities in the great West. They were fleeing for their lives. And I think we cannot forget that, even as we're seeing these thousands and thousands of people trying to get across Europe.
Well, that's a very good point. And back to you, Dimitrios Papadimitriou, for your take on that as well. I think we do need to go back. Even if we cannot solve the problem, we have to understand how it started. Now, many people are talking about the threat from ISIL, also known as ISIS, the so-called Islamic State now in Syria and in Iraq. We have the West, particularly the United States and other allies, are trying to crack down and trying to defeat ISIL. But many analysts who know the region well say that, yes, ISIL is very dangerous, but that the root cause, in fact, is the regime of Bashar al-Assad, that he has cracked down on his own people, and that refugees leaving Syria are mainly fleeing the Assad regime, the barbaric manner in which the Assad regime is attacking its own people.
Well, certainly I will take no issue, because there's no issue to be taken with what my colleague is saying about the root causes of all this. And it all depends how far back you want to go. The Middle East has been a hotbed of situations in which rights get trampled or citizens actually get targeted or not targeted, but they nonetheless die because of errant kind of violence, etc., etc. And it is, I think, instructive to point out and note that although the rise of Syrians in the overall proportion of people who are coming to Europe in the last 2 or 3 months has been almost exponential. In other words, every month, Syrians are comprising a larger proportion of the total. I'll give you an example. In July, they were about almost two-thirds. In August, they will be well over 70%. We also note that an awful lot more Iraqis are now joining the Syria exodus, as it were, and try to make it to Europe. And we know what Iraqis are fleeing. They're fleeing in a complete failure of not only the local and the national institutions, but also the international community. And there is plenty of responsibility and blame to be distributed there. But the fact remains that we do have this extraordinary crisis. It is growing, and Europe has been very wise in the regard with which particularly Germany has been receiving what will amount to hundreds of thousands of Syrians. And it's important to note that Syrians, and presumably Iraqis, will get this special standing of refugees, while the others, you know, will have to prove things in a much more regulated way. So this is overwhelmingly and increasingly a refugee flow. But there are also migrants, what Europe calls economic migrants, that are mixed in the overall flow, and that also needs to be said. And even the United Nations Refugee Agency, the UNHCR, has basically said those people who are economic migrants, who under regular circumstances, you would try to see whether there might be a way to give them some opportunity in our countries, may actually have to be removed, because you need to make space for all of these refugees who are coming in, and you have to be able to demonstrate to your public that when the public is being asked by their leaders to make this extraordinary effort of openness toward refugees, you also have to tell them, to demonstrate to them, that only these people who need and meet the qualifications criteria for refugee status will stay. The European Commission, by that I mean the European institutions, are particularly incapable of actually doing much about it. The initial responses, as will the consequences of this, will be felt by the receiving country and the refugees. And we need to focus on this rather than expecting Brussels to somehow solve problems.
But Brussels should establish standards,
nonetheless. It will establish, it has established. Europe is full of standards, as it were. You have the European Convention on Human Rights, which is far broader than the Refugee Convention. And you have, in addition to that, national legislation that goes even beyond that. So in terms of generosity in legal terms, at least, and in the last few months, generosity in spirit on the part of some of these countries, this is the most amazing thing. I don't know what's going to happen if the flows keep, in a sense, doubling every 6 months.
Well, of course, that leads us to, we need to address the root causes of the problem, and we'll get to that in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Dimitrios Papadimitriou, from whom you just heard. He's a distinguished senior fellow and president emeritus and co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute here in Washington, and Rafif Joyjati. She's the spokeswoman for the local coordinating committees in Syria and director of Free Syria. That's a nonprofit humanitarian organization. And she's a member of the executive committee of the Day After Project. We are talking about the root causes of the refugee crisis in Europe and what should be done to address them. This is a reminder that you can listen to Encounter online as a podcast. Please visit our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA, or keep up with us on Facebook. Here's a shout out to our loyal listener, Joe Kofi from Nigeria. Well, back to you, Rafif Joyjati, because once again, in order to stem the flow of refugees, once again, there's one question of how to accommodate them, whether throughout Europe and even in the United States. Many say the United States could be doing more, but we are hearing that the United States is committed to resettling approximately 10,000 Syrian refugees. At any rate, I want to again ask you if the West, the United States, Europe, are they addressing the problem in Syria in particular in the right fashion? This concentration on trying to combat ISIL, one gets the impression that they see ISIL as an even bigger threat than the Assad regime, who many say is actually at the root of the crisis. And how should the U.S., Europe deal with Syria?
That's a very, very long answer that I'd like to give you.
Please.
But we'll go maybe in no particular order. I think what Europe is doing is applying a Band-Aid to something that requires surgery. The flow of refugees will only increase as long as there are barrel bombs and chemical weapons and mass executions. The flow of refugees is not going to be stemmed because Germany has generously opened its doors, or Austria has made similar movements, or that the United States has pledged to take in 10,000 people. This pledge was made a couple of years ago, and so far the U.S. has admitted, I think, 1,500 people. So these are Band-Aids of varying sizes. Today we hear that Russian military personnel have taken control of Damascus International Airport. So now we know that the country of Syria is occupied by Russia, Iran, Hezbollah, and the Assad regime. We have ISIS, whose members were released from Syrian prisons at the beginning of the revolution. They were armed and told to go out and participate in demonstrations, thereby giving some legitimacy to Assad's claim that the demonstrators were all terrorists. What we have today is a civilian population that is desperately trapped in the crossfire of these parties. We have the West being absolutely paralyzed in terms of how to react to all of this, doing nothing to support the moderate opposition, or doing very little in substantive terms to support the moderate opposition, to support those moderates who have taken up weapons, who would be a likely counter to the Assad regime and to ISIS. Now, the moderate, secular, armed opposition is fighting multiple enemies with virtually no support from other parties. This is the situation we're in.
And just a quick follow-up, do you see any movement on the part of whether it's Europe or the United States? I mean, we do recall back in 2013 when the French were ready to strike Assad and the United States said, well, we're going to remove chemical weapons. They did a deal with Russia. So it's not like there wasn't an impulse on the part of many allies to attack the root cause of the problem. But the question now is, are you seeing any movement to truly deal with the problem now that the Russians are there in a much more visible way? That would be probably a deterrent.
I think the Europeans and the Americans are having very lukewarm discussions about how to take action. I think their state of paralysis has now put them in a state of coma, if you will, and this has given perfect opportunity for the Russians to move in full-blown to occupy Syria and to fight Assad's war against a civilian population. I think we give a lot of lip service to the need for a political process, and that would be fine and well as long as the parties to that political process were legitimate and were sincere in looking for a political solution. What we've seen time after time with Kofi Annan's initiatives, with Lakhdar Brahimi's initiatives, and now with Dimistura's initiatives, that the Assad regime is not interested in transitioning power. And so we have to come to the conclusion that a political solution is not viable. And instead, what we need is a military solution. Now, Syrians for the past 4 years have been begging for a no-fly zone, begging for a stop to the barrel bombs, to those Russian-supplied warplanes that drop both barrel bombs, cluster bombs, and chemical weapons on civilians. I don't know that the Russian presence is going to help bring about any such dream of a no-fly zone. I think that's going to be another deterrent.
Back to you, Dimitris Papadimitriou, because, of course, you just said that there may be many, many more Syrians fleeing unless we address this cause of the problem, notwithstanding there are refugees fleeing, you know, Libya, and, of course, you mentioned Iraq increasingly. Many analysts are saying, for example, in the case of Syria, in order to stem the flow from Syria through Turkey, Greece, and then up to Europe, that perhaps the need for safe zones. Do you see any kind of talk within the European Union, you know, addressing this part of the problem?
I think what this problem needs is leadership in terms of the international community. I think my colleague is absolutely correct that not only do we need to create, you know, hope for lives lost, for lives to be resumed around Syria, but we need to do the most difficult thing, because it is the most difficult thing, which is fix the situation in Syria. I think, and here is sort of a very indirect way of arguing the same point, that the refugee crisis may provide an absolutely essential impetus for all of these countries to get together and say, this is unsustainable. Everybody knows that this is unsustainable. It's not particularly good for the people who are fleeing. It is not for the people whose countries they are going in. Incidents will happen every day. And at the end of the day, you're going to have more and more people, and then create all sorts of difficulties about how do you build Syria back up. So it's probably going to have the combination of what it is that my colleague talked about. If we don't do that, the region will empty of all the people that would be absolutely essential to actually rebuild the country. Now, it's interesting enough, people who are coming to Europe are not just leaving from the three countries around Syria, they're also leaving directly from Syria, those 12 million displaced, half of the population of the original population of Syria. You know, where are they going to go? We better do something about it. And I think the European Union will coordinate decisions and actions taken by key member states. Germany needs to step up to the plate. France needs to take the lead because it's a country that doesn't shy away from, you know, military operations and things like that. The UK will have to play a part in this, the United States. A coalition has been built among the English-speaking countries over the weekend. Australia said they will participate. The Canadians will participate. So if you wanted to see hope in all of this, perhaps there is hope.
Absolutely. Some say that some of the Gulf countries could and should be doing more to absorb the refugees. What is your perspective?
My perspective may not be very politically correct, but I would condemn those countries that financed Islamist movements in Syria, who stirred a pot, who promoted the use of weapons, and then withdrew when it came time to actually put thought and resources into helping on a humanitarian level. Utter condemnation. Those Arab countries that have not brought in a single refugee, how can we talk to them as Arab countries? What is the meaning of being a commonly Arab country if those brothers and sisters, as they call themselves, cannot accommodate a single refugee?
To what extent you see any political will, particularly on the part of Europe, the United States in particular? Many say the United States has not shown enough leadership. The Obama administration has abandoned or tried to withdraw itself from the region. To what extent do you attribute responsibility to the administration, and to what extent do you see any kind of change in the offing? You know, where do we go from here?
I put a lot of blame, and I think I voice the opinions of millions of Syrians. We put an awful lot of blame on President Obama in particular, who drew red lines multiple times, who issued threats repeatedly to Assad, all the while giving him the green light to massacre his own population. We have a lot of resentment toward the governments in Europe who were ready to impose a no-fly zone or help militarily to solve the issue in Syria, and they did not, presumably due to U.S. pressure. I would like to jump on a couple of words that my colleague used, and they were hope and rebuilding in the future of Syria. And I would hope that among your listeners there would be a debate that doesn't only involve political or military solutions, but also looks at the work on the ground by civil society. I think it's very, very important to include civil society in any future rebuilding efforts. And I'm very happy to say that there are hundreds, if not thousands, of organizations that have been established on the ground, and they are building schools. Despite the risk of the schools being bombed, they're building them anyway. There are organizations like the Syrian American Medical Society who are routinely administering medical and emergency assistance to civilians. There are hundreds of women's organizations that are preparing for the future of Syria. And so while the headlines really focus on refugees versus migrants, barrel bombs and chemical weapons, and ISIS, we are ignoring the fact that there has now become a layer of citizens who are focused on rebuilding and surviving.
Well, I'm afraid that's all the time we have on this edition of the program, but we will certainly be discussing this issue, the refugee crisis, and how to solve it in the many weeks and months ahead. I'd like to thank my guest, Dimitrios Papadimitriou. He's the President Emeritus and co-founder of the Migration Policy Institute and President of Migration Policy Institute Europe, and Rafif Joyjati. She's spokeswoman for the local coordinating committees in Syria, director of Free Syria, and a member of the executive committee of the Day After Project. Thank you both for your terrific insights.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
Encounter was produced in Washington. Thanks to Anna Zalewski for booking our guests. Our engineer was Wojtek Zorniak. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.